rest of the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, community radio.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31st, 2021. At PCC's Cascade Campus, Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services Programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Thank you so much for joining us. Just a quick reminder before we jump into the show, right now is a great time to show your support for this show and for KBOO Community Radio in general. KBOO has been selected to be part of this year's Willamette Week Give Guide, and we have a goal of reaching $50,000 by the end of the year. So show your support by going to kboo.fm/give. And also one other quick plug here. We'd like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. So be sure to check them out at laborradionetwork.org. And so now on to the meat of our show here. Now that the Electoral College has voted and Joe Biden is officially the president-elect, despite what you might hear from our current president and a large cabal of his craziest supporters, we figure it's a good time to take a look at what working people can expect from the Biden administration's approach to labor policy and his support for the labor movement more broadly. Biden has claimed to be a union guy who is not anti-business. He's also promised repeatedly to be the most pro-union president you've ever seen. And during an AFL-CIO event on Labor Day, he went as far as to say that he will be the strongest labor president you've ever had, which are, you know, big words and very promising, you know, rhetoric coming out of the Biden administration. But today we're going to look at, you know, the things that he has said he wants to do and sort of, you know, weigh that against his record and also what he actually will have in the ability to do as president with a divided House and Senate. So, you know, beyond that, as we all know, there are things that, you know, Biden has said on the campaign trail, and then there are things that he has done in his, you know, 40 plus years in office. Now, you know, Biden has said he is a union guy and unions have largely endorsed him, but we do know that there is a massive difference between what the leadership of unions say and who they support and, you know, the individuals and policies they support and what the rank and file membership support. And so I think, you know, that is something that a lot of unions endorsed Biden, but a lot of union individual members maybe may not have supported him in the primary. And so things like that, you know, there are definitely people understand the differences between what someone says and what they've actually done. And so just looking at his record, obviously, you know, during this most recent presidential campaign, it was funded largely by billionaires and by, you know, he took a lot of campaign financing from Wall Street and Silicon Valley. And in fact, his first ever campaign event of this last cycle was hosted by a man named Cozen O'Connor, who is or was a union busting Comcast lawyer. And so that's, you know, that was as his first event that signals something. In the same way that, you know, in 1980, when Ronald Reagan ran for president, his first event was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, declaring, you know, basically an end to the civil rights era. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, it sets a footing. It sets an agenda of where you're going, whether or not you actually say it or not. And so that, you know, keeping that in mind, he's also, you know, currently on his transition team, you know, the team that is helping his administration come into office and you know, take over the reins from the outgoing administration.
Yeah.
There are a number of corporate lawyers and lobbyists that have been appointed to all different sections of that transition team. You know, there are definitely union members on there, but I think it is definitely outweighed by CEOs, executives, and just generally.
Yeah, there's been lawyers. Some controversial picks for sure.
Absolutely. And so, you know, things like that definitely are good to keep in mind. A quote from Jacobin magazine, Alex Press wrote in Jacobin saying that if we want to predict how a politician will govern, the smart money is on, well, tracking the money. And so, you know, if you consider the fact that Biden received heavy endorsements and heavy financial support from Wall Street and Silicon Valley, it stands to reason that his administration will likely not govern in a way that is directly adversarial to them in a, you know, in a situation that is worker versus management. I think we can expect some balancing or potentially some siding with management on that simply because they have funded his campaign and previous campaigns. I mean, including the fact that Biden as a representative and then a senator from Delaware has been a loyal foot soldier of the credit card companies for his entire career. And on top of that, while in the Senate, he was a massive supporter of NAFTA, and more recently as the vice president of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah.
He also voted to repeal Glass-Steagall, and he does not, you know, he has said and repeatedly said that he does not support things like single-payer universal health care. He does not support a Green New Deal, which is a massive jobs program, you know, in its essence. He does not support tuition-free colleges and universities, which would disproportionately help working people. And, you know, just looking at his record again, as VP under President Obama, after the two of them campaigned heavily on passing on the idea of passing a national card check bill, which would make it easier for workers to join unions, they once elected and in office, they quickly turned around and abandoned the Employee Free Choice Act, which would have included that reform. So again, you know, just things to keep in mind. Just one more point on this, on his record. Labor historian Gabrielle Winant wrote in The Guardian, in a recent article in The Guardian, that at no point in his career has Biden proved willing to take the slightest political risk on behalf of workers. His appearances in union halls occur when he needs something from labor. And in the research for that article, he found only two instances in which Biden walked picket lines with workers, and both of those instances occurred during his presidential campaigns.
Yeah.
So again, that just sort of sets the tone for where Biden is coming from. That does not necessarily indicate where he is going or where a Biden presidency would actually fall on the worker versus management side of, you know, argument. But I think it is important to keep all of those in mind. And so, you know, having said all that, I think we're now going to go into the things that Biden has said he wants to do as president and the things that he can do.
Yeah.
So look at the more positive side of things.
Yeah. And, you know, just to add on a little bit of that, I mean, I think a lot of people in the media and just abroad have kind of, you know, rightly pointed out that this is one of, if not the most progressive campaigns to ever have won the presidency. And I think it's important to look at that record in doing that, right? Like, I think there's still a long way to go when it comes to, you know, I think pushing, you know, the Democratic Party to the left and, you know, keeping them more in favor of the working class and things like that. And I think it's going to be up to everybody to help keep the campaign honest and things like that. Like, progressives really turned out for Biden in 2020. And I think that's really important. And, you know, also, you know, it's not really over yet because, you know, the results from Georgia at the beginning of next year are really going to help determine even more so, like, is it a small or big risk for Biden to help workers, right?
Exactly.
So I think it's really important to have people in those areas still be super connected to what's going on and make sure we're kind of on top of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, you know, we haven't even seen where all the chips have fallen yet. Like, in Georgia, the results of that are going to determine whether or not the Democrats have a majority in the Senate, or if McConnell is still going to be in charge. And if, you know, the difference between that is huge, you know, despite the fact that even if they do win the two races in Georgia, that still means that they will likely need to get Republican support to pass almost anything because it's not filibuster proof. But if they lose even one of these two runoff Senate races in Georgia, then McConnell and the Republicans still control the Senate, which means effectively nothing, no bit of his agenda, of Biden's agenda, is getting through the Senate. And, you know, case in point on that, like, look what happened in Obama's second term when McConnell was, the, the, you know, the, leader of the Senate Republicans and essentially set about being his entire goal is just shutting down Obama's every chance or every attempt to pass anything.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, like, that's, those things are still yet to be determined. We will not know about that for another month. And yeah. So, you know, that does change.
But I mean, even things, you know, even other things like he campaigned on can become more or less difficult, right? Like a $15 minimum wage, exactly. Right? Like he yeah. campaigned pretty, maybe not heavily, but, you know, he made it pretty clear that he intended to do that. And he even lost a state like Florida that passed it.
Right.
And I think, you know, all of these different outcomes of who's kind of in control will set the tone for how difficult something like a $15 minimum wage
yeah.
would ultimately be.
And that, yeah, that actually, that really leads us perfectly into the idea that, like, regardless of what happens in the Senate, regardless of what happens, you know, on the other branch of government, there are things that, as the executive, Biden and his administration can do
yep.
without needing the approval of Mitch McConnell and those demons over there in the Senate Republican side of things. But so there are things that he can do, you know, most specifically, like overturning a lot of the Trump era executive orders. Like, that's a big thing that an incoming president is able to do to change the tide of things.
Yep.
And so with that in mind, like, overall, I think the Biden administration will likely mark a return to the Obama era precedents and major changes, you know, to national labor policy will sort of fall in line with what we saw during the Obama administration and potentially move forward a little bit from there. Biden, you know, as you said, he's a union guy. And so one of his big things that he's been touting is that he's likely, or he would like to increase union membership. And he'd like to do that by facilitating organizing, shortening election periods, and reducing mm-hmm. the bargaining period for first collective bargaining agreements. And so, yeah, the quickest and easiest way that a president can do things is through executive orders. And so things like Biden will likely reinstate the 2016 Obama executive order called the Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces Act,
yep.
or executive order. And under that order, it applied to federal contracts of at least $500,000. And it required that contractors disclose labor violations from the past 3 years to determine whether or not they were eligible to receive a federal contract. Mm-hmm. And that executive order also required pay information to be disclosed to workers. It also included a prohibition against mandatory arbitration agreements for some larger contracts, and it mandated the development of a website to manage the information collected under the executive order's provisions. So that would be a thing that he could do on day one without yeah. needing the approval of any Republicans anywhere. And that would be, you know, again, like falling back in line with where the Obama administration was in terms of the balance of power between labor and workers. Another thing he could do as, you know, executive order is to mandate that all federal contracts pay out a minimum wage of $15. So like yeah. all federal workers and all federal contracted workers receive $15 as a minimum wage. That does not necessarily say that it's the law of the land for the entire country. That wouldn't be the national, the federal minimum wage. It would only be for people working for the federal government, but still, that is a step in the right direction.
Yep.
Now, the big fish, the big thing that if the Democrats were to take back the Senate and you know, win both races in Georgia, the big thing that Biden has said he's in favor of and that we have actually talked about previously on this show is the PRO Act, passage of the PRO yeah. Act, which is the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. In February of this year of 2020, the House actually passed the PRO Act, but of course it was a non-starter in the Senate. McConnell did not even bring it up for a vote. Biden has in fact signaled his intent to strengthen unions and to support the PRO Act. Now, you know, doing that would, you know, there's a bunch of things that are involved in what this act is, and we have, you know, you can go back to a previous episode and sort of dive into that. But the main things are that it would make it easier for workers to join unions.
Yep.
It would eliminate right to work laws, which is a huge problem for, you know, organizing, union organizing around the country in all the states where it's passed.
Yeah.
And it's that's a threat of having, you know, if if Trump had won another election, that may have been a thing that would have become federal law.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those things that we're not going to dive into, I think, here on this episode, but is important to look into and is, I would say, very strangely named.
Yes,
it is. And is named in a way similar to, like, you know, when you think of, like, pro-life or things like that, it can be confusing as to, you know, it's hard to fight right to work because it sounds really good.
But it's like Citizens United.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, but obviously it doesn't help workers.
Yeah, it's newspeak. And so, yeah, that would be a huge thing that, you know, it would overturn right-to-work laws, you know, eliminate those. It would also impose new penalties on employers who retaliate against unionization efforts. Mm-hmm. It would crack down on employee misclassification, which is a big thing. And, in fact, that's a big thing that we discussed last month on our episode. And it would establish new rules so that employers cannot delay negotiating collective bargaining contracts. Yep. So that once it's, you know, once the unionization has been agreed upon by the workers, they couldn't just put off negotiating
that. And I think it's important to remember that a lot of the stuff that, you know, we talked about for the PRO Act is it's not only going to help the industries where it's accepted that there are unions, but there are a ton of white-collar jobs where unionization is becoming more and more feasible, and these things would really help new types of unions and new industries where we haven't seen them before get started. So it's a really big deal.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, like, you know, that's something that we have seen an explosion of over the last decade, but really in the last, you know, during the Trump era, it seems, is an explosion of, like, tech sector unionization and media unionization. Mm-hmm. Like, areas that, you know, traditionally, well, tech didn't really exist, but, like, traditionally media was a unionized area. But then, you know, over the financialization of our economy over the last 40, 50 years, those things really did whittle away at the union, you know, the union representation in those areas, and they have exploded back in a big way in the last few years. And I think that likely we're going to see that, you know, that trend continuing of, like, stronger unionization in areas that have been unionized, and also new industries being unionized. And so, what the Biden administration, you know, over the next 4 years, what they do to help that process and to make it easier for workers to unionize is going to have a major impact on it. And things like the PRO Act would go a long way to
help. Yeah. You know, and we have covered it too. Technically, Kamala and Joe Biden came out against Prop 22.
Right.
But they didn't really do a whole lot against
it,
though. I mean, they did come out and voice their concerns about it.
Yeah.
And that's another one of these things where, you know, that is just another chance for an industry that isn't going to really be able to unionize as we see it propping up across multiple other states too.
Exactly. So, like, it's a thing that is just going to spread. And luckily, you know, the PRO Act, if, you know, so if that is something that is able to be passed, the PRO Act does include in it a provision that would set into place, like, federal law that California's ABC test would be now federal law, which is something that was a big factor that was basically repudiated in the Prop 22 decision. But that would essentially determine, it determines whether or not an employee is a contractor, or whether or not a worker is a employee or an independent contractor. And there's three points that you have to meet in order to be considered an employee. And so those are if his or her job forms part of a company's core business, if the boss directs the way that the work is done, or if the worker has not established an independent trade or business. And so the PRO Act would codify all three of those, that test apply to workplaces around the entire country.
Yep.
That would basically be important because under the National Labor Relations Act, only employees have the right to organize. So by setting those standards for determining who is an employee versus letting each individual employer determine the classification of whether or not you're an employer or contractor, is a huge boon to organizing efforts everywhere. Another thing that the Biden administration would be able to do is appoint an entirely new National Labor Relations Board, which is, it's a huge thing. And the Trump appointed board did a lot of harm in the 4 years that they were there. And again, you know, this would be a two-step process of reversing some of the things that were put in place by the Trump National Labor Relations Board, like overturning some of those decisions made, and then also moving forward, ruling on cases brought to them more favorably towards workers. To take a break here for a moment and to reintroduce what we're talking about, if you're just joining us, this is Labor Radio. Thank you for joining us, and we are discussing the incoming Biden administration's approach to labor and what can be expected from working people in terms of, you know, labor policy from our incoming government. And so we are discussing right now what the National Labor Relations Board under a Biden administration could do. Some of the big things that I think they could do right away, a newly appointed board, would be to reinstate, so basically go back to, you know, overturned Obama era determinations, specifically reinstating specialty healthcare, the specialty healthcare decision of 2011, which the Trump NLRB overturned in 2017. And that essentially endorses the concept of selecting micro units while evaluating potential bargaining units within a workplace. And so that would essentially allow for smaller groups of disparate workers within an organization, as long as they have common cause, to unionize together. And not allow the employer to say, well, no, they aren't related jobs, therefore they cannot unionize together. So it sort of expands, it allows unions to get a toehold into an employer's operation from which it can expand its representation.
Yeah.
On top of that, there's also the Biden administration's NLRB could reinstate the Purple Communications decision of 2014, which the Trump NLRB overturned in 2019. That decision was determined that employees had a National Labor Relations Act protected right to use work email accounts for organizing purposes, even if the employer prohibited non-work related use of email accounts. So, you know, that's a big thing. If you spend all your time at work and you maybe don't have the contact information for, you know, all the people around you on your personal accounts, you would be able to discuss and reach out to them to discuss organizing and unionizing through that.
You know, and it stops too. I mean, you know, we touched on it last year, but, you know, all that Barstool stuff that went down David Portnoy of, he's like, hey, if you try to do this, I will fire you. You know, he tweeted it doing a bunch of dumb illegal things. And I think this is an important part of that, of just making sure that people aren't threatened by kind of talk like that when it doesn't really apply. Yeah,
and that's, you know, it sort of does feedback into what we were saying a little bit earlier, which is like in this era of new industries and new types of workplaces coming into the, you know, the realization that the workers need to unionize. Like, you know, if we were discussing a factory, or if we were just, you know, the what you think of traditionally when you think of working class,
quote, yeah,
unquote, you know, you may think of either like a service sector job or like a factory job, and those workers may not necessarily be on email all day, may not have work provided email accounts. But in this era, or in the new eras, or the new areas where people are trying to unionize, whether that be a newsroom or a media collective or a tech company, I mean, those are workers that are tied to their email addresses, are constantly, you know, communicating that way, and oftentimes have their personal and their work emails tied together. You know, that's basically one account that you're just using all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you are working, you know, if you're at work late hours and stuff, you may not necessarily have a personal connection outside of your work communications with all of your coworkers. And so that's a really important thing that I think probably just was not thought of, you know, maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And is now a big element of organizing. And the final, just to sort of wrap this section up here, the final thing that the NLRB could do right away, a Trump-appointed labor relations board could do right away, is to return to the joint employer standard, which was articulated in the 2015 Browning-Ferris Industries decision, which was, of course, overruled by Trump's labor relations board in July. Now, that decision determined that an employer's status as a joint employer is based on the employer's reserve right to control employees, as well as the indirect control over employees, which essentially, you know, this is discussing the idea that franchised and like who the employee has to negotiate with, and who would actually be responsible for negotiating with the union in a franchise-owned situation. So if you work at a Subway, and are you dealing with that individual owner, or are you, like, you know, that franchise owner, or are you dealing with the corporation Subway?
Yeah.
That's the big thing. Mm-hmm. That this would allow you to actually, you know, it would set in stone that you are, in fact, depending on which situation, you are dealing with the corporation Subway, or you are dealing with that individual employer. So that would set actual parameters on that.
Yeah. But I think that shows, you know, in terms of just the things that Biden can do without the Senate, in addition to just where he puts his political capital, right?
Yeah.
And in addition to the executive orders, you know, we talked about some of the controversial picks, but the people that he selects for a lot of these kind of, you know, positions that are just appointed sets the tone for how the next 4 years are going to go and what's going to get repealed and what the focus of these departments is going to be.
Right.
And obviously, you know, for us, anything is going to be a step forward when, you know, you have people in charge of departments who actually believe in that thing, right? A secretary of education who believes in educating public education, you know, things like that. But I think it is fair to ask for, especially on the promises of the campaign, for to deliver on some of these things that, you know, a lot of the progressives turned out for.
Yeah. And I mean, like exactly like you said, I mean, there are 2 degrees here that we're dealing with. There's, you know, the first turn of the knob, which is just getting the corporate pirates out of these places, like the, you know, the DeVosses and the Zinkies, you know, or I guess that's an old name at this point, but like the people that Trump appointed to head the different departments and to, you know, appointed to different positions, who were there basically exclusively to destroy any government oversight or to ruin that agency, whatever it was. And, you know, so that's the first turn of the dial. And so if we can reverse those things, that is definitely a step. And and that is something that I think we can are almost guaranteed to see under a Biden administration.
Yeah.
That next turn of the dial, the next step is moving from just stopping the bleeding of a Trump administration to actually progressing things and moving things in the right direction.
And making consistent progress, right? I think everybody on the left has to be pretty proud of our institutions.
Yeah.
And the ability that they had to stand up to, you know, some pretty fascist and authoritarian decision making and policies, right?
Yeah.
But those same institutions that stopped us from that also stop other forms of change that we would like.
Exactly.
So I think it's really important to, again, as we've been talking about, hold the administration accountable, stay active. Like this political stuff, you know, the great turnout in the 2020 election of people voting, it's important that we keep doing that on a state level too for all the stuff that's going to come up, because the change the other way is going to take just as long and be just as hard. So it's kind of the double-edged sword of, you know, we get to be proud of these institutions that make things, you know, one man can't change the whole country, but it means a lot of people are going to have to get together to make things right.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, this is a big ship and it turns slowly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the thing is, like, it can turn into a iceberg very quickly, but, you know, to get it on the right course can take a lot longer, you know. And I think that it is, you know, this election was a mixed bag. It was definitely positive in the sense that we did get rid of, you know, I don't think we've ever gotten rid of him, but we at least have kicked Trump out of office. He's no longer going to be a thing that we need to deal with every single day. But we have to continue to hold the Biden administration's feet to the fire.
Yep.
And, you know, there's a big thing that came up during the campaign was the rhetoric around, you know, from Biden folks and centrist Democrats of like, well, you know, push him, like, elect Biden and then push him left.
Yeah.
You know, don't ask for anything right now. You got to get Trump out of there. You got to elect him, then push him left. And that he might be, you know, he could be the most progressive president ever. Like, all those things were said, but now we're at a point where, okay, great, we did that. Progressives turned out across the country to get him elected.
Yeah.
Like, you can thank the election of Biden in a large part on grassroots organizing and progressive activists.
Well, I mean, over the last, like, 60 years of unions getting small, even more than that, of unions increasingly getting smaller every year and the union population shrinking, like, that's been Republican presidents, that's been Democratic presidents. So, you know, it's the goal here, right, is to improve the conditions and especially right now of people who, you know, aren't really getting paid because they aren't working, or, you know, they don't have a stimulus package. Like, all of this stuff, it's going to be really important to stay focused on, and improving the situations of workers today in America has to be a really big goal.
Yeah, especially considering that we've now gone 9 months, and I know that, you know, there is still discussions about including, you know, whether or not to include a stimulus check in the new stimulus bill. But, like, we are at a point where, without any serious intervention, this ship is sinking. And I think that if we just rest on our laurels and sit back and say, all right, well, Biden's in there, he's going to do the right thing, we are going to end up back here in the same, you know, back in the where we were a month ago in 4 years.
Yep.
And we need to now build on this win and, as he said, push him left.
Yeah.
And we need to continue pushing for progress, because it's not just going to come to us. Biden is not going to, he may do a flurry of things on the first day, you know, the first few months that placate people, but it's the long term. It's the footing that they're setting. It's the people they're putting in charge that we need to keep an eye on, and we need to keep pressuring them. Yep. And you know, it's going to be a long fight, and it will probably take, you know, beyond this individual presidency, mm-hmm. but we can get there. And it really is about organizing on the ground. It is about strengthening labor power. And so that's the message of the show. And unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to Labor Radio. Again, I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
If you'd like to continue this discussion, you can find me on Twitter at Michael B. Cath. Tune in next month in January, and we'll be back on the third Monday of January to keep bringing you great topics. So have a great rest of your day.
This is KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be